consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
I'm gonna float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. George can't hit what his hands can't see.
There's a new home run champion of all time, and it's Henry Aaron.
George to drive, hang, fire,
hit! He scores!
You believe in miracles? Yes!
And again, and Donovan has scored! Oh, can you believe this?
Oh, and it is! Oh, for a touchdown by Holmes!
Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier!
Welcome into the Ninth Circle. I'm Kyler Mead, joined by Alex Gallant, Trey Lanthier, as always. So glad to have you with us. So excited to be back for episode 2 of season 2. How you guys doing? Exciting,
sounds
exciting
like a,
week.
The start of a long-running sitcom here or something. Episode 2, season 2.
Hopefully long-running. Less laugh track. Well, I don't know. We kind of do a little laugh track just behind Trey every now and then.
That's right.
It is. It's an undercurrent of conversation.
Little do you know, we just have a crowd of 50 people hooked to a mic behind the wall here.
One day,
laughing
gentlemen.
Every time Trey says something.
Recorded in front of a live studio audience. It's the Ninth Circle. Man, great week this week, y'all. We had a Cardinals win for Arizona people. Didn't really impact some of us as much as that impacts some people in Arizona. None of us, really.
Well,
Chargers win,
got
Niners
really negatively
win.
Negatively impacted by that result.
But much
this
more
is
importantly,
true.
Obviously, because who cares about the Cardinals? Let's be honest. We had a Sun Devil just destruction, dismantling. Just what's other words?
Woodshed.
Woodshed time.
The woodshed
for Illinois. Woodshed time. Just a fantastic game, y'all. And I mean, it's
that
now,
might be an understatement.
Okay, and you know, now we're late in the week, obviously, and so the game for the most part has been broken down. But I mean, just the one impression for me, at least, from just watching this team was that there was no moment during that game where I wasn't confident they were going to win. From the second snap of the game, there was no moment, not when they fumbled on the one, not when they gave up a touchdown after scoring a few. There was no moment in that game when I had any doubt that they were going to be able to just march right back up the field the next time they got the ball.
I would buy that. The Illinois defense looked confused. And they had much of the same players except Winnie Merciless, who left last year. But they had Jonathan Brown, who just wreaked havoc on Osweiler 2 years ago up in Champaign. He was a non-factor.
Mm-hmm.
They had him confused the entire time. Somehow Chris Coyle was like open every time.
And
every
that's,
play.
That's Jonathan Brown's hood, too.
Yeah.
And he just squatted right down in it and did his business.
That is right.
It was beautiful. Beautiful business.
It was great to see. ASU, you know, they beat NAU, and we were talking about maybe we're getting too excited
about the preseason scrimmage.
But this is another update. NAU beat UNLV.
That's right.
That's a huge win, and that makes ASU look that much better.
No kidding. I mean, rankings-wise, certainly that's important, but it's more important just for the sake of how we interpret that ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
And
that was on the road. That was in UNLV.
Yeah.
So
not to say UNLV is like a great program, but they're a real program.
Yeah.
You know,
they are real.
They're
in a real conference. I would debate if they're a real team, but they are in a real conference.
They're the only football team that even plays in Vegas. But I mean, maybe arena football.
There you have it.
Maybe.
There it is.
I don't think there is arena football.
No, there's
in
not.
Vegas. The XFL was in Vegas.
All the leagues are just weary of going to Vegas
for obvious reasons.
It's
the whole gambling problem that they have there. Yeah, lots of gamblers. In that area that may try to thwart the game's results.
Lots of socioeconomic. So as we were saying,
was that your recap of what I said?
Yep.
Pretty
so
much.
As we were saying,
you can tell that just went downhill fast.
There's no question. Getting back to the Illinois game, real quick before we move in onto bigger and better things, what's going on? Just a couple of days now. There's no question that obviously we saw a team that was helped by backup quarterbacks being in, but. They were still playing. It was the same defense, and the defense was the real strength last season. And so it was just this team that I don't think it was just me. It was just this air on the field. Taylor Kelly believed he was going to complete every throw. And for about a quarter and a half, he did dug on it. You know, it was just that sort of absolute confidence. And I think that's the Todd Graham effect. That's what's been instilled in this team, is it's discipline, and discipline begets confidence, I should say, in all walks of life.
And it's such a contrast from last year, when every play
it's like
we're thinking about Vontaze. Oh,
Vontaze's
gonna get a penalty. Oh, you know, Dennis Erickson's gonna call a swing play. It was so predictable. So, and this year, you never know. You never know what's gonna come up. You don't know if they're gonna run. And which running back they're going to run with. They have a carousel of them in the backfield. You don't know which quarterback they're going to throw with. You don't know if the quarterback's going to throw a run. You have no idea, no way of predicting this offense and the way it goes.
I would say the NFL equivalent to me has got to be the 49ers. There's just – think of another team in the NFL that just – they come in and you just – they know what they're doing and they execute.
I would say
and
the Patriots – the Patriots are pretty good at executing. There's,
no, not to say that the Niners are the best. I'm not saying anything like that. I think the Patriots are a better team all around and that they execute. But there's just this confidence and this discipline, and it's all – you know that it all comes from that coach. It all comes from
I
that
would
coach.
Agree with that. Yeah. I agree
the
that.
Change
the coaching
that happened,
effect, yes.
The
yes,
change that happened in San Francisco when Harbaugh got there, and just the energy in that team, the accountability that you can see on the sideline, the excitement in that team, it's the same thing that I'm seeing with the difference when Todd Graham got to ASU.
So to put it bluntly, Todd Graham is to Jim Harbaugh as Dennis Erickson is to Mike Singletary.
That perfect.
Wow.
That was
wow. Analogy time.
The end. The end of all things that need to be said about that. I would say that is pretty darn accurate. So we've got a whole new game though. Here we got Missouri.
Hello.
A much higher level. Much higher level of competition in this game.
Yeah.
Much higher.
This is by far.
And again, I mean, we're talking about probably the bottom of the SEC, but the bottom of the SEC is a lot better than the bottom of the Big Ten, and that's who Illinois was. And missing a quarterback for Illinois. We're talking about a much, much different offense. We're talking about a much different defense. Why don't we have, you know, it is a team that, yeah, we played last year, but there's obviously changes. I wanted to have the two of you guys, starting with you, Alex, kind of break down what the Sun Devils are coming up against, what this Missouri team does well, what maybe their weaknesses are. They did lose last game. Just what's the deal with this team? What's the skinny, Alex, on the Mizzou Tigers?
Well, the entire offense revolves around James Franklin, quarterback who played against the Sun Devils last year when they lost in a overtime thriller in Tempe, 37-30. Everything revolves around him. As I said, he was involved in 69 of the 79 offensive plays that occurred in last year's game, and I figure that to be no different this time around. He's a dual-threat quarterback. He doesn't necessarily gain the most yards when he runs, but he keeps defenses honest. So when he does pass, there's more openings for really a stellar cast of wide receivers, the best that this young, inexperienced, thin Sun Devil secondary is going to encounter this Saturday. Two wide receivers I really like from Missouri, the veteran T.J. Moe. He's more of a possession-type receiver. Think of like a Wes Welker comparison in the NFL. He's going to get his catches. It's just a matter of if he just goes off and makes a huge difference in this game. Then the really intriguing guy to watch out for if you're a Sun Devils fan is Doriel Green Beckham, number one wide receiver recruit in the country last season. Had a choice to go to Arkansas, but he decided to stay home and honor his commitment to the University of Missouri, and he's going to make an immediate impact. And that's the guy that concerns me most for the Sun Devils. The Sun Devils do not have a starting defensive back 6 feet or over. And Doriel Green Beckham is definitely a Calvin Johnson, Larry Fitzgerald type receiver. Aggressive, goes for the ball, can stretch the field on the Sun Devils here, and he's someone to definitely watch out for.
Well, and then another thing, that the Sun Devils haven't played an athlete like that on the offensive end yet this season. I mean, the only player on the Illinois offense really was Nathan Shielhouse. I mean, you could argue they have a solid running game and some backs in their backfield, but for the most part, Shielhouse was the cornerstone of that offense, and with him out, you didn't really get to see the Sun Devils play against a serious offensive threat, and this Missouri team has a lot of them. I mean, they have a running back who can really perform well, Lawrence and Franklin, always going to be a threat, especially on the ground for the Sun Devils. So, and as you said there, Alex, they have some threats in the receiving corps as well. So there's a lot of players in this Missouri team that can perform, and we haven't seen ASU face a test like that yet. So this is by far the real point at which we are going to see how far the Todd Graham effect is going to stretch. Because if he's as good and is great at shaping a game plan up as he seems to be these 2 weeks in, then this is going to be the biggest way for him to prove that. If he could shut these guys down, I have no doubt in my mind that the Sun Devils are going to make a bowl game this year if they start out 3-0.
Yeah, and going back to the wide receiver really quick, I left out Marcus Lucas, who's a 6'5 junior from Liberty, Missouri. That's another big body to go opposite of Green Beckham, who is 6'6, 220. Those are going to be two wide receivers that have a huge height advantage over any Sun Devil defensive back. I expect Osahani Irabor to be placed on either one of them, but that leaves another wide receiver open. And Dorial Green Beckham on the year only has 4 catches for 37 yards. He is due for a breakout performance, and if you're a Sun Devil, you hope that that does not happen this Saturday.
Well, yeah, and as I said, you know, the Illinois wide receivers, the star Lankford was 6'0".
Yeah.
6'0", 175 pounds. Not a big-time athlete and not a hard guy to defend if you're a smaller size corner. So you know, untested is the best way I would put this defense in terms of real star capable players.
Interesting. That is some deep stuff, guys. I appreciate that. Looking into a couple of things, and just I'll bounce a few things off you. In the Illinois game, ASU allowed, let me see, here we go, 231 rushing yards. They also allowed Illinois had the ball for 35 minutes and 16 seconds versus 24-44, in part because ASU scored so damn quickly, but that's a lot of possession, and rushing increases possession, obviously. In the running game, outside of the QB, you know, is that a situation that they're going to be able to contain, and are they going to be able to focus on keeping the receiving core intact? You mentioned, and you're exactly right, guys, that you know, this is an inexperienced defensive backfield for ASU. It's going to take a lot of focus for them to stay on these, and especially when rushing the passer, which they've had reasonable success with so far this year. When you're rushing a mobile quarterback, it's just that much more difficult. And I think back to you know, games, Sugar Bowl games with Ohio State when old what's his name the band Oakland, now Oakland Raider, would just
Terrell Pryor,
thank you, would just after that, under that just terrible rush from, I want to say, Arkansas, would just fly away, and they were all over him. And that's what happens in college when you get these great, you know, pass rushing defenses, which ASU hasn't been great, but has been pretty dang successful. And I want to, you worry that they're trying to cut down the pass game by rushing the quarterback, and he just escapes. Is there anything that Todd Graham, anything that this defense that you guys have seen that you think that they'll be able to do to counter that? Because I can imagine that being a massive problem in this game otherwise.
Well, getting Brandon McGee back is going to be a big boost for the defense. Just to have that the captain back on the field, really coordinating. And last week there weren't many major problems with the defense, and there's nothing you can really point out except for the running game, where they gave up 231 yards. And when you think about it, down the stretch, Illinois just started running on a consistent basis, and a lot of those were concession yards. We have to understand that the defense starts playing back once you've got such a deep lead that the last thing you want to do is give up a deep play. So for all purposes, you know, intensive purposes, this wasn't really a 230-yard performance in my eyes by Illinois. I would say it was more comparable to 170 to 200-yard mark. But either way, that's still something that the Sun Devils have to watch out for with Kendall Lawrence from Mizzou, who last week against Georgia had a pretty 41-yard game. Not great, but he only had 8 carries to go with it. And in his game one, huge game, 121 yards, 2 touchdowns. So he's a guy you got to watch out for, and I think the Sun Devils are going to have trouble containing. They're going to have trouble. I don't see, unless they can really construct a game plan where they're going to clog up the middle, which, as you guys know, rushing quarterbacks love just rolling out to the outside and running up the sideline. It's that scamper play, and James Franklin knows how to expose that. We saw that last year. So it's a question of what are you to give to get, you know, you got to make a trade-off. You have to decide what's the most imminent threat in this team. Who can you isolate and take out?
Interesting. Alex, is there a counter for this that Todd Graham might have in his pocket?
I wouldn't say so. I think there's too many weapons on the Missouri offensive side. If I were him, I would key in on stopping the pass. You have too many big play receivers for Missouri. I would let them get their yardage on the ground, and in, by doing so, it shortens the game, fewer possessions. That's how the Sun Devils are going to win the game.
Well, let's get a little bit more just kind of some theoreticals here. Missouri lost, as we've mentioned, against Georgia. One of the best teams in the country, let's be honest. Losing to Georgia is not anything to be ashamed of. It's a team that very nearly beat LSU in the SEC championship game last season. Obviously, a few changes, but excellent, excellent SEC team. They know how to play defense. They know how to move the ball when they need to. And it was a very close game going into the fourth quarter. It was just kind of took off in the end. Missouri played them well, lost. What does this game mean to Missouri?
This is huge for Missouri. This is a game you can't go 1-2 in your first season in the SEC and expect to be considered a contender in that conference. You have to establish yourself early on. Otherwise, if recruits are thinking, I'm going to go to an SEC team, why would they ever go to a basement team? You know, and the problem is when you're at the bottom of the SEC, you're going to sit there because those teams only get stay as good as – I mean, they're going to be great forever. If you want to compete, you want to make that statement early on. If they want to be in the top 50% of that conference, I mean, it's by far the most competitive conference in pretty much any sport, but especially in college sports. And you're not gonna be able to compete there consistently if you can't come in and make a statement early on. They've got a great team right now, and they're poised to succeed at least to the point of getting to a bowl game or some sort of form of success. But if you're starting out 1-2, you got to see your fan base becoming demoralized, especially with two losses at home. Against, you know, Georgia, yes, and then but unranked ASU coming in and beating you, that can't be a very boostful win or loss, rather.
Boostful.
A little booster shot.
No, but I hear what you're saying.
A little pediatric knowledge.
So looking at Missouri's schedule, they play 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 ranked opponents. Arizona State, who could be ranked with a few wins, could be ranked sometime this season. Vanderbilt, who's played well
solid.
This season.
UCF,
who has been good
beat
for
Ohio
the last
State.
5 years. Very, very solid, solid school. Very program on the rise. That's a hard schedule. This is one of those games that Mizzou has been looking at since the preseason and saying, okay, obviously we've got Southern Louisiana or Southeastern Louisiana, and they handled them 62-10, pretty well done. And then Georgia, that's the big test. And then ASU, we can relax a little bit. We've got to win it, though. We must win the ASU game because then we come right back with South Carolina, UCF, Vanderbilt, Alabama, Kentucky, Florida, Tennessee, arguably a break with Syracuse, and then Texas A&M, who could easily be ranked by that point in the season.
Well, I would go so far to say if they lose this game to Arizona State, they're not going to make a bowl game. Try finding 5 wins in the rest of that schedule.
That's a great point.
I don't know
at South Carolina,
3 wins in that schedule.
Versus Alabama, at Florida, at Tennessee,
it's a must
at
win
Texas
game.
A&M. Those are 5 losses, and that puts you at 7 losses. You're done. You're 5-7.
I think there's more on the line for Missouri here than there is for ASU. ASU's expectations coming into the season were like 5.5 wins. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't still hope to win this or that they shouldn't have as leave everything on the field, but there's clearly a lower level of expectation for this ASU team as there is for the Missouri team. ASU losing tons of star talent. Missouri returning their starting quarterback who dominated last year and is hoping to continue to do the same this year. In their first season in the SEC, top conference in football, all this stuff. They've got a lot on this line.
In comparison, Arizona State started off, as we know, against NAU, then went with Illinois, one of the worst teams in the Big Ten. Now they've got Missouri, who's a big step-up game, but after that, Utah, Cal, Colorado.
Those are 3 winnable games.
That they've got to win, you know.
I would say Cal.
Cal's an up and down.
It's going to be tough.
Oregon,
Colorado, Utah
lose.
Must wins, especially with Jordan Wynn leaving the team Utah.
Oh, yeah. Oregon, which they should lose. UCLA, which will be a heck of a game.
That's going to be a great game.
Oregon State should be a good game after the Oregon State show they can beat a good team.
USC loss.
USC should be a loss. Washington State
win.
Should be a win. And Arizona's going to be one of the biggest games in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And, I mean,
I would agree.
A win here, what does this mean for the ASU program? Where does this rank in big wins in recent ASU history, if they beat Missouri right now?
I think this would top last year's Missouri win.
Oh, obviously.
Because, for one, it's on the road. The big thing about last year's Missouri win is that everybody at that point said this team is going to contend for the Pac-12 South title. And then they went on to become 6-2, just like everybody thought they would, before falling apart and collapsing with a 5-game losing streak to end the season. But this game is much bigger than that. Much bigger than that. When you compare to any game last season, I mean, the USC game from last season was huge. But this is a chance to start 3-0 to become a ranked contender, a contender for the Pac-12 South. Yes, I'm saying it. I think USC is a dominant team. Don't get me wrong. But ASU has a cakewalk of a schedule for the next three
yes,
games.
Yes, they do. Yeah,
for the next three
they
games.
Could go 6-0.
If you can start 6-0, who can say that you can't build up enough confidence, enough momentum to pull off any given Saturday win and just pull off an upset and become a huge team? Now, I'm not saying they're by any means going to, but this type of game is the one they could do to prove that they have the capability of at least putting something together to make that type of run.
All right, let's switch it around then. Three days from now, ASU lost less than two touchdowns. Reasonable game, but a loss. What does this mean to the season?
I think it's like a reality check. It's sort of like, okay, we knew coming
we're still ASU.
Exactly. We knew coming. It's the same thing that the Illinois game was last year. When ASU went out to Illinois, lost in a real. But the thing is, last year there were much higher expectations. This year they're not. So losing this game really is not that big of a blow to ASU fans, except the ones that for some reason believe that this is an amazing team or better than last year's team in terms of talent. And to me, I don't think that's the case. Coaching wise, discipline wise, sure, they've got them beat. But expectations wise, I see this being a 6 or 7 win team, and I'm happy with that. I would be set. I would be content with a 6 or 7 win finish to the season, and that's what I'm setting the bar at. So to go in this game and get a loss, that's just me going, listen, what did I really expect from this team? What was I really looking at from this team? I expected 6 or 7 wins. That's probably what I'm going to get now. 3-0, huge, whole different story. But let's say they go in, get a loss as expected. That's what I come out thinking. I come out thinking, yeah, you know, it's the team I thought they were. They are who they thought they were.
I don't know. I'm looking at the schedule. I'll be honest. Not to say that a 7-win season isn't likely, looking at a lot of these teams that could easily beat them. But I think a 7-win season would feel like a failure to me. I feel like this is a season where they should win 8 games.
I disagree.
I think really? A 7-win season.
I say not 6. 6 would be a failure.
6 is a failure.
7 is the content.
Is the push.
Is where the content meter
is. After what we've seen from this team already and what we know they can potentially
do. But what have we really seen? We've seen 2 home games against.
Big Ten team has never won in Sun Devil Stadium.
Not only that, they've never won, but they didn't even have their starting quarterback. They didn't have their best player, arguably, on the offensive end.
And their
third
stringer played better than their second stringer.
Exactly. I think that this team remains untested. We thought the Illinois game was a test because we didn't realize how good this team actually is. But the real test is when you're going on the road, SEC opponent, if you could pull up a win there, you've got me. You've proven to me that you can contend with anybody.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say 7 would be fine. Good season, good first year. Obviously, 8 or 9. I don't think they're
getting
to
9.
But 8 would be fantastic, I would say.
To win 9, they'd have to beat UCLA.
Or
Missouri.
Checking this
UCLA
up really
Missouri.
Quickly. The spread in this game is 7 in favoring Missouri.
Yeah, that's so, another point. Game, if it was a 2-touchdown win, I wouldn't be as happy as I would be if it was a touchdown loss. Mm. Or 2-touchdown loss compared to a touchdown
as
loss.
As long as it's a close game, I'm going to come out thinking,
yeah. If they score a mercy touchdown or something to make it 14 at the end just to put them away, that's different. But if they go down 21-0 and have to work their way back to a 14-point loss at the end, like 35-21, that's a different.
Well,
it depends how they lose. Are they going to come out and make a statement, or are they just going to fall away early in the game?
Just think, when you check the ASU schedule before the season started, you see the Missouri game? Cross it off. Man, that's an automatic loss. No way. No chance. No way. And now we're talking, maybe they could win. Every prediction I've heard has been 7, 3, 5-point differential. And 3 weeks ago, everyone I asked would have said, are you kidding me? Is that even worth talking about? No. ASU's done. ASU's done. Hopefully they can beat NAU, though. Hopefully they can beat NAU. Yeah, I'm pulling for them to win NAU. That's what the outlook on the season was 3 weeks ago. Now we're talking about them possibly winning. They've already met any possible hopes I could have had at this point in the season.
Good points, guys. That's some intelligent analysis. I got to be honest, and that's what you get from the Ninth Circle when these two guys are talking and not me.
don't humble yourself.
All right, prediction time.
Hit it, Alex. You got it.
First, we got a prediction coming in from social media.
Oh, here we go.
Danny Shapiro's dad is making a prediction here. Shout out to Danny Shapiro's dad. Danny Shapiro says he cannot make a prediction due to unspecified reasons, but I'm assuming his work with the state press is fine.
Conflicted interest with
the state press. But his dad is perfectly fine with making a prediction, and he says the Sun Devils are going to win.
All right.
30-24.
Yes, Trey's pumping his fist. We've got the Mr. Shapiro endorsement.
Yep. Hey, I'm telling you, that's a good sign. That's a good jinx right there.
Fantastic. That makes me feel good.
As far as our predictions go,
yeah,
I would go Missouri with the win, 35-30. Going to be a great game. Going to be one of those games where it's going to tear your heart out at the end.
Think it comes down to the wire?
Yes, Missouri's going to win.
A heartbreaker. I don't know.
70,000+ fans.
You've just said, Trey, that you would be happy if that was what
happened. They are out for blood.
But heartbreakers, they stick with you, man.
They're going to be out for blood after losing to Georgia, and especially after Georgia's fans criticized Missouri's fans for being impolite.
Something we didn't touch up on was that this team lost a heartbreaker of its own against the very same team, ASU, last year. Out here, this was a demoralizing blow to Missouri's season. They were ranked. ESPN was covering the game. It was a huge match. They had a chance to win it. They had an makeable field goal from 40-yard distance, I'd say.
They would have won if Gary Pinkel did not jinx them.
Yep. Called ice his own kicker twice.
He went to the Jason Garrett School of Iceology.
But you have to think that that's going to be the pump-up for this Tigers team. Go in the locker room and go, guys, listen. Remember what happened last year? Those guys beat us on a fluke. Are we going to let that happen again in our house? No. No, you're not going to let that happen again. But you know what? In spite of everything that I have said in Missouri's favor, I believe in Sun Devil Nation. That's right. I'm raising a pitchfork in the radio studio, folks. And you know what I also believe? I believe in Brandon McGee and Todd Graham's defense. I'm not calling these high scores everybody else is. I'm calling 27-21. That's right. You heard it here first. That's my prediction. And if I'm right, I'm expecting these two to treat me out to dinner. They're laughing at me now. They laugh now.
Well, dinner?
I'm laughing at the score. I'm just laughing at the
presentation.
They laugh now. But just wait. Just
the
wait.
Ron Wolfley approach to presentation.
Just wait. Just wait.
Like Woody Page or something. Just going all out.
Just wait, folks.
Hey, I hope you're
just
right.
Just win, baby.
27-21.
All right,
ASU 3-0 to start the season.
After listening to Alex's breakdown, I have lost a lot of confidence in the Sun Devils.
Come on, man.
I don't think the defense can handle it. I think the offense will continue to dazzle.
They'll play well.
I think they're unbelievably high executing.
Georgia put up 40+, and they're a pro style offense.
There you go. Okay, so I'm going to say high scoring, but I agree. I think Missouri will beat them.
You guys break my heart.
I'm going to say.
Circle. Oh, and here we go. One more prediction coming in.
Before I give my
from the social
prediction.
Media.
From the
Ross Dunham.
Bum, bum, Dunham.
Vaunted Cronkite School member.
Yes, indeed. And contributor to the CronkiteSports.com web site.
Enterprise?
Yes.
The web site.
Give it to
us.
Is
that what they call them these days?
They call them a website now.
Ross Dunham goes Arizona State with the victory, 34-30.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, finally.
Oh, one more. We got one more. They're flying in like hotcakes. They're flying in like hotcakes. Ryan Bafalukas on Twitter, at Ryan Bafo.
WCSN contributor.
He's going to go with myself. Missouri, 38,
Baffo.
35, Missouri victory, quote, ASU secondary will get torched.
And that's what I have to say as well, unless there's anything else coming in from the social media.
There's nothing.
I am predicting a 37-28 loss.
Wow, 11 points or 9 points? Do I do math right?
4 touchdowns, and they can't hold the offense.
I'm sorry. I was busy on the Twitter sphere. What was this score?
37-28.
Okay.
ASU scores 4 touchdowns. Okay. but they can't stop the
okay,
offense.
According to my prediction, they actually are going to score more often than Missouri, but lose the game. Three touchdowns, three field goals. Missouri, five touchdowns, will win the game.
All right. All right. Well,
the closest wins a
I hate to say
sports bookie internship.
I hope. Hey, I hope. Listen. Yeah. Well, listen.
It's gonna feel great.
Like Trey
was
saying,
it's gonna feel great.
Like Trey was saying, Missouri's in practice right now, saying, "How could they let this? How can we let this happen again?" And there's some folks in the media right now saying, "How can they let this happen again?" Talking about a couple of hockey players, couple of hockey owners, and a little bit of a dispute going on. We've got a very special
little
guest
bit of a
coming
dispute.
On. Little bit.
Dispute. Just a little bit.
I think it's like. This is like divorce.
Well, we're
dispute.
Gonna find out.
This isn't just a parental.
We're
right.
gonna find out just
this
how they can
divorce court. Divorce. This is like divorce court, like the people's court. You know all those cheap
judge
shows
Judy?
You see on TV. This is
Judge Joe Brown.
NHL.
Judge Joe Brown?
NHL would be the defendant. NHLPA the plaintiff.
There it is.
But we're gonna have someone much more knowledgeable than us talk about
very
this next.
Very special guest is gonna be on the show. Look forward to it. A real journalist, folks.
Michael Bloom. Shout out.
You're in the ninth circle. All right, welcome back into the ninth circle. My name's Kyler Mead, joined by Alex Gallant, Trey Lane Thier, as always. We've got a very special guest joining us from the West Coast, Helene Elliott, sports columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Helene, thank you so much for joining us. We know it's late out there.
Yeah, it's a little late, almost past my bedtime, but I'm still awake, sort of.
We really appreciate it. Well, big news, obviously, maybe, hopefully, part of what's keeping you awake, not just us. We understand that the NHL, NHLPA met earlier today for the first time since Friday. What's the information that you've got on that?
They exchanged proposals, and they inched a little bit forward on a couple things, but they're still millions and billions of dollars apart, and I don't think we're going to see the NHL season starting on time.
Oh, that's terrible news.
Sorry, don't blame the messenger.
No,
absolutely. Now, from the information that you have, do you have any specifics on the things they did move closer on, or rather the things specific things that they're not moving any closer on?
Well, one of the key points was that the NHL wanted to redefine what's called hockey-related revenues, which are the revenues that are shared with players. The NHL originally wanted to exclude some revenues and just keep it for themselves. Now they've decided to go back to the definition that was used in the bargaining in the labor agreement that's going to expire in a couple days, and that was something the players wanted. But the two sides are still very far apart on percentage of revenues. They haven't even gotten to the point of talking about free agency and some other big issues. So there's a lot of talking to be done and not a lot of time to do it.
Do you know, I mean, why now versus before? What's been the impetus? You know, we've been trying to keep up on it as much as possible, but when they finally do come back, what's causing that?
Well, it's tough when you got all these billions of dollars to share, isn't it? We all know that, right?
I know. I have a hard time sharing all my billions
of
dollars.
Yeah, I know. It's just what bothers me is, you know, we saw that here with the NBA lockout, and there are people, arena workers, you know, people who sell food at arenas and who clean the place and who run the elevators and who provide security. And these are folks who need these jobs badly. And these are the people who are going to lose a significant chunk of work, and that's what bothers me. Yeah, I mean, players, hockey players and players in every sport have very specialized skills, and if somebody's going to throw a huge contract at them, sure, hey, why not? You know, take it, absolutely. But when it gets to this point where you're quibbling over percentages, and it's millions of dollars when there are people who are going to not be able to pay their rent or not be able to buy their kids Christmas presents if this lockout lasts because they need these, you know, $15, $20 an hour jobs that they may have.
Yeah, now, Helene, I'm reading in your column from the LA Times on September 1st that the percentages that the NHL wants is to go from 57-53% that was put forth in the last collective bargaining agreement in favor of the players to 54-46 in favor of the owners. Now, you're saying is that that's mainly the main talking point that's keeping them far apart right
now,
correct?
Is that what's now been abridged?
That's been updated now.
Yeah. Okay. It's been updated.
As of today, it was 49 was what the NHL was offering, but it would go to 46 for a couple of years, and then the last year of a six-year deal, it would be at 47. And the players are stuck on what they had, which was 57. And although they indicated they might be willing to have some flexibility, but I mean, I think this whole lockout was inevitable. Once the NBA and the NFL had their labor situations and their players took cuts, and I think that the NHL owners watched that and just are completely drawing their strategy from that.
And then going off free agency, you mentioned Kovalchuk getting the 17-year deal offer before it was reworked to 15 years over $100 million, and then Ryan Suter and Zach Parise to the Wild. These are the big contracts that are occurring in free agency, and the owners are letting it happen, but at the same time, it's also affecting the current labor situation, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the New Jersey Devils outbid everybody else by more than $20 million for Kovalchuk, and that was really completely foolish. He's not the kind of a centerpiece player who's going to win you championships. He's more of a secondary kind of player. He's not an all-around guy. He's a scorer. But nobody put a gun to their head and made them give him $100 million. That was their choice, and you know, you get to do whatever you want as long as you stay beneath the salary cap, but you know, the inflationary impact of that deal and so many others just put them in the position they are now.
I think if you look at, and we're joined by the way, Helene Elliott, sports columnist for the Los Angeles Times. When you look at a lot of stuff that's going on in the NHL, there's no question that some of these deals have just been absolutely ludicrous. And talking about, you know, Kovalchuk doesn't deserve something like that. None of the guys that get these 13, 15, 20-year contracts, it's just hockey players are getting beat up all the time. But again, like you said, nobody made them do it. These players are just taking what's being offered them.
Exactly. And you know, again, these are people with highly specialized skills. These guys are the best in the world at what they do, and more power to them. And so many of them, their careers are short. I mean, I think the average NHL career is probably about 5 years, not much more than that. And, you know, you want to get the money while you can, and that's fine. But, you know, the owners in the last collective bargaining agreement, the last time they went through this and lost the season, they said, well, you know, we had to get the salary cap because we needed cost controls. We had to get it right. Well, no sooner did they, quote unquote, get it right than they punched enough holes in it to be wrong.
Now, have you heard anything? We watched with the NBA, a lot of these players went overseas. There are some very successful overseas hockey leagues, in Russia in particular, I'm thinking. Have you heard anything about some of these players thinking about, if there is a lockout, as you're saying, pretty well likely there's going to be, have you heard any talk about players maybe bolting overseas, maybe to limit some of the leverage that these owners might have in their agreements, or at least just to feed their families?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody, to be honest with you, is in danger of not being able to put bread and milk on the table.
That's probably true. I might have
been certainly if they are, they should be firing their agent for not putting money away, knowing that this is coming. But, yeah, I mean, some players have looked at the Russian Continental Hockey League. But one of the key issues here, as it was for NBA players, is insurance.
Sure.
I mean, what happens if you go and play in Russia, or you go and play in Finland or Sweden or someplace, and you tear up your knee? You're not allowed to use your NHL team's medical facilities. You're not going to get the treatment from them. So it opens up a huge world of bad possibilities.
Have you heard anything? And, you know, we want to talk a little bit, and we're going to get a little bit more into it briefly about your Kings, obviously. Have you heard anything about any specific players that have been speculated about that? I know it's early in the process, but I mean, that would be a huge detriment to a team coming off of this big historic Stanley Cup title. I'm sure to any team, obviously, but have you heard anything about any specific players?
Yeah, it's just so, you know, the Kings waited so long to win the Stanley Cup. 1967, they came in the league, and their fans have been so incredibly loyal and patient, and now they're going to have to wait just a little longer here to see that banner raised. I think players are hesitant to commit right now because they don't want to be accused of not bargaining in good faith. If you stand there and say, yeah, I got something lined up in Sweden, then the league can say, well, you're not bargaining in good faith. You're anticipating a lockout. Mm. So everybody's being kind of cautious on that regard, and I don't blame them.
Well, Helene, I think the biggest question, and you touched up on this a little bit earlier, everyone's been asking themselves sort of, how has this been allowed to happen, being that an entire season was wiped out just 7 years ago in the 2004-05 season? How can the league...
And with as much as that did to the sport, too.
Exactly, and how much it's grown since then, how can they allow themselves to go through this again?
Yeah, and that's a really good point, is that, you know, you can look at the last lockout and you say, well, nobody wants to lose a season, but they had to make a complete change in the economic system. They put in the salary cap. They changed everything that they had done. So you go, okay, I can see where owners might say, yeah, we lost the season, but all the money we gained by getting cost controls, by putting in a salary cap, it's worth it. You know, they also got the 24% rollback on salaries after that lockout. So as an owner, you can sit there and say, okay, we lost the season, but we got so many other tools that should enable us to run our business well. But this isn't about a philosophical thing. This is just about percentage points. Is it really worth it?
That's true.
Yeah, that's true. Going back to the Kings really quick, Dustin Brown spoke with ESPN's Pierre LeBrun, and he said, growing the game here in L.A., we have 15,000 season ticket plans for next year. With the lockout looming, I don't know how many of these season ticket holders are going to be season ticket holders if we start in November, December, or later. I know that hockey bounced back in 2004, 2005 after the lockout, Helene, but do you think it's going to bounce back as quickly as it did then, or are some Kings fans and NHL fans going to lose patience and maybe drop out of their ticket plans?
Well, one thing that teams tend to do is they make you buy tickets in advance. You're committed in advance. So all these folks have already put down their money. To be a hockey fan here or in so many other American cities, you really have to be a fanatic. And people will come back. I'm convinced of that. But because for a couple of reasons, and number one, the passion of most hockey fans, and number two, hockey is still best seen in person, not on TV. And the most passionate fans are going to want to be in the arena. They'll grumble, and with good reason, and I don't blame them. But I think most of them will come back.
I wonder if, honestly, if the Kings, I mean, probably stand to lose the most, because with the momentum coming off a championship year in any sport is always massive. And kind of what Alex was just talking about, is there any push that you've heard from? I'm sure that the owners are doing a great job standing very unified, but have you heard inklings of any kind of push on that? Because they've got to be standing to lose more than almost anybody else in the NHL.
Well, it's interesting, though, because there's been no repeat Stanley Cup winner since 1997-98. So, in reality, a later start to the season might actually help the Kings.
Interesting. Yeah, it would give them more time to rest.
Give them more time to rest. And yep. Jonathan Quick had some minor back surgery over the summer, so this would give him a chance to recover even
further.
That's
interesting. I hadn't thought about that. That's interesting.
Yeah, Jonathan Quick, obviously, a big part of that team. And as you said, it might help them, but... Switching gears just a little bit here, a lot of the blame in the lockout from 2004-2005 fell squarely on the shoulders of Gary Bettman, the commissioner, for many of the right reasons. But this time, it seems like he's sort of being pushed around a bit by the owners, per se. Do you think that statement has merit, or do you think Bettman still holds the cards here?
I don't think that they're... I wouldn't term it as being pushed around by the owners. I think that... You know, Gary Bettman is certainly not a sympathetic figure. He's not a lovable guy. But for the owners, he's been terrific in that he's made their franchise values go up, or at least most of them. And look at what the NHL's revenues keep going up and up and up every season. So he's done well for them in a business sense. And, you know, the economy was so bad a few years ago, but the NHL kept adding sponsors and has done very well in that regard. So I think most owners are behind him. Certainly, you can't say that he hasn't brought them financial return, and he works for them. People keep saying, "Oh, Bettman should be fired. Bettman, how is Bettman letting this happen?" Well, the commissioner in every sport works for the owners, not
right.
for the fans.
It's true. Yes, it's true. Well, Helene, you're the columnist for the LA Times. You cover the Kings exclusively, and we kind of want your outtake with the lockout in effect. What's your take on the Kings for this upcoming season? What's your outlook on this next season for the Kings?
Well, again, it depends on when they start, and my guess is still going to be around January 1st for the Winter Classic outdoor game would be the likely start date. But I think it could, again, this could help the Kings. They won't have that traditional Stanley Cup hangover. They will have had more time to rest. But, you know, I think that you look around and many of the teams in their division and in the conference have improved themselves, and the Kings really haven't added anybody. They've managed to keep their whole team together, which is pretty remarkable, but they haven't added anybody, and I think that they still need a scoring winger, some help on the left side, and they could still do that, obviously, at some point.
Okay, and quickly, one last question before you let you go. I've been itching to ask this to someone that actually works in the LA area. How big of an impact did Daryl Sutter have in the second half of the season last year? Because it seemed like they were an entirely different team once he took over.
Absolutely, yeah. They would not have won the Stanley Cup if they hadn't brought him in. I'm firmly convinced of that. He brought in a fresh approach. He brought in a different kind of atmosphere than what players were expecting. People thought, oh, he's going to be nasty. He's going to yell. He's going to be cruel. He's going to scream at them. And he wasn't. I think he read the situation very right. He knew that they were slumping and scoring. They weren't scoring goals. He needed to rebuild their confidence, and that's exactly what he did.
All right. Helene Elliott, sports columnist for the Los Angeles Times. You can read her work in the Los Angeles Times and latimes.com. Is that correct?
That's it.
And Twitter handle?
It's Helene, not Helen.
All right.
At Helene, not Helen.
That's good. I
correct.
Like that one.
Yeah, because everybody, so many people mispronounce my name. I figured I may as well remind them how to pronounce it.
That is a good reminder. Right.
Very
nice. That's good. And that's hard when you're in print because people aren't saying your name all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Helene, we are so grateful for you joining us. We know it's late. We're going to let you get back to bed. But seriously, the content, fantastic. We're so grateful for your time. We've all learned quite a bit. we try to keep up on it, but there's only so much that we can keep up on just from reading what.
Oh, of course,
already.
Sure.
Helene, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your night.
And, you too. Thanks, guys.
Have a good night. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, that was Helene Elliott, sports columnist, Los Angeles Times. Really grateful for her joining. Great content. That was fantastic. You can hang that phone up, Trey.
He wanted to make sure she was gone.
Wanted to make sure she didn't have any last moments of glory.
Well, Alex, what were your impressions from that? Alex, that's, by the way, yeah. Alex Gallen getting that interview.
Just throwing
well
that
done.
Together here.
Fantastic. And the last second, really, really great. Man, so grateful
to her.
That was really, really fantastic. What so knowledgeable.
Well, and I think we got so much insight into what you, like you just said, Kyle, you cannot find that stuff in an article because, no, I mean, it's just too boring to write about in a way. And what she was talking about, though, really, really gave a lot of an insider look at the most current, up-to-date information on this NHL lockout that's, honestly, one of the biggest stories in sports right now.
I was
off the field or out of, you know, the actual playing area.
I was surprised and, to be honest, kind of disappointed to hear how little the owners seem to be, like, from what she was saying, how little they like, she feels they have reason to be concerned.
She did not seem very optimistic.
And that was the big thing with the NFL was they were going to lose billions of dollars. You know, maybe that's the situation where with the NHL, it's not as lucrative as far as TV deals, as far as advertising, as far as gate sales. It's just not quite as much. And so they just don't stand to lose as much as the NFL. And I kept trying to get her to say, just because it would make me feel better, you know, you're right. And we all did. You know, you're right. After this happens, and you did as well, Trey. After this, you know, this would be a big blow to the sport. Because the owners have got to know that, and that's got to mean a bigger hit to their pocketbook. And she didn't seem to really. And I mean, that's good, I guess, for hockey fans, because I guess we don't have to worry. Because honestly, I have had that worry. You know, if this happens again, you know,
then
maybe
it just
the
dissolves.
NHL. Because look at what happened last time. They had to, they lost their big TV contracts. They had to go on Versus. Like, that was so depressing. You know, the
Well, that's another thing to talk about. The fact that NBC Sports Networks has been starting up and building around this hockey. I mean, finally, you're starting to get a bigger platform.
The TV stuff has been coming back.
Exactly, yes. Exactly.
But still, they need to do some work on that.
Definitely. Yeah, still, but you can't. But the lockout will never help that.
True.
The lockout will never help that.
Because if I have the choice, I still watch the Canadian Hockey Channel, Hockey Night in Canada.
See, I've never watched that, so I can't really give my insight. But
that's true.
But apparently, Alex watches all the time. So.
Yeah, but I
will
say... Is that
available here in Phoenix?
No, it's not. But ever since they switched to NBC Sports Network from Versus, even though it's the same channel, the content... Just the overall presentation.
Yeah, the production.
And we've gone back and we've revisited the old NHL on ABC and, you know, all those themes and stuff. And those have been gone now for years. And it's in large part because of the lockouts, because people lost interest. And listen, like, they've got to sign something, you know, and NHL isn't good enough to wait for. It's just a reality as far as TV goes. And she's right. It's better to watch in the stadium. And it's just... In the arena, I should say.
Well, that's something, but
it's just disappointing that she really didn't. It didn't sound from her perspective that the owners have all that much. There's just not a lot of leverage from the players.
There's just not a lot of optimism on the owners'
end.
She did say
the January 1st game. She expected that, and that kind of is
the Winter Classic.
Yeah, and that's good, I guess.
That would be a lot like the NBA last year when they started on the most significant day of the season on Christmas Day.
They would lose more.
It would be more. I understand.
And I don't think that the NHL can condense a season the way the NBA did.
No,
probably
they're not.
True.
They're just going to be. They're going to start.
They would just play that many games.
So you'd lose that much more. What was great, the NBA season was condensed. It was more fun, although a lot of people do say, you know, maybe it causes more injuries. But regardless, it was a lot of fun for the viewers.
I think it was one of the more entertaining NBA seasons I've watched in a long time.
The big debate is because a lot of people think that it had a big thing to do with the injuries that we've been seeing to some of these big players, Derrick Rose, Dwight Howard, guys like that. It was great because we still got 66 out of 88 games, the majority of the season. We wouldn't get that with hockey because they can't condense the season. We just have this awkward shortened schedule.
That
sucks. You know?
I still am holding out hope that they're going to get this done before the regular season.
I tell you.
There's going to be a lockout.
Yeah.
There's no way they can write everything up by Saturday. But
they still have two and a half weeks
until the regular season. But as you're about to say, probably, she didn't sound very confident that that was going to happen.
She sounded pretty confident that it would not happen.
She did not sound confident that it would be resolved at the start of the regular
season.
We're saying the opposite thing. We're just using
the
same thing.
Putting more emphasis on, rather than saying,
she was confident.
I don't know if it'll be resolved. It was, I'm pretty dang sure it's not going to be resolved. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like, that was the air. I got from her, agreed. And that sucks.
That is too bad.
And you know, the only discussion I haven't heard talked about too much is whether or not Canadian hockey leagues will get more attention whether if the NHL were to fall apart this year and just not have a season, or even delay it till January 1st, would hockey fans adopt any lower level of hockey, or would they just completely drop it altogether?
No. In America, no.
This is, it's like it's the reason nobody watches the MLS. It's because people just nobody wants to watch not the best. And this is the danger that the NHL runs, is if they put themselves in a situation where they can no longer attract the best talent, or where they're frustrating for the best talent to be there, that's what's going to lose money.
But
because
they're still the highest paying league.
I agree.
I mean, they're still going to be the biggest destination for anybody.
I'm sure that's the case. But hockey is big in Canada. Hockey is big in Russia and Eastern Europe.
True.
There are big leagues, you know, that people can go to and get paid. And that's what the NBA has over everybody. The Turkish leagues, Chinese leagues, they're not paying anything like what they pay in the NBA. It's the same thing. That's what the MLB has. There's nowhere to go. Japanese leagues, give me a break. You know, it's the NFL. There's literally nowhere to go. You know, CFL is the only option. And so that's why these leagues, these big four leagues, are so incomparable to MLS, which is the next biggest major league sport, because the MLS is not the best talent in the world. Because they want to play in Europe. And if NHL is the closest to that of any of these sports, and it's just a risk that they run. And I don't think it's incredibly likely, but it's just something to be aware of.
Yeah, and in the end, these lockouts, NFL, MLB,
I'm sure I'm blowing
NBA,
things out of
NHL, you name it, they all stink. I mean,
yeah.
But as she said at the beginning, they're fighting over billions of dollars.
And let's, you know, just, it was important to her to say, and she was right about it. It's the worst for these families that work in the arenas and work in the underneath, you know, washing the team's jerseys and dirty jocks and making them food and cleaning their lockers and cleaning up the arena so that we can come watch them. It's the worst for them because they depend on the NHL to actually put food on the table, you know. And she kind of gave me a little bit of a hard time, you know, saying with the NHL players having to worry about that. And she was right.
Yes.
There's a reality of that for these families that depend on it. And, you know, everyone that was all up in arms about the Coyotes potentially leaving and what that could mean to the whatever 500,000, I don't know, whatever amount of employees that are employed because of the Coyotes.
Well, that would take out the jobs.
It would take out those jobs for the entire league, for all around the country. And that would, in these times, would be absolutely terrible.
Yeah, so definitely, if you haven't gotten a chance, log on to latimes.com, or if you're listening to us in the Los Angeles area, just pick up a copy of the Los Angeles Times.
Indeed.
Check out Helene Elliott's work. Her latest column from September 1st, NHL, good at getting labor negotiations wrong. A lot of good points in there, so check that out, latimes.com.
It's at Helene, not Helen, on Twitter. So give her a tweet. Thank her for coming on the Ninth Circle. And that's how we get new guests like that on the Ninth Circle.
That's right.
So, unfortunately, that's all the time we've got. The interview was so long. She gave us so much of her time. And we really got into that Missouri
But it was well
breakdown.
Worth it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Two
well
solid
worth
topics.
It.
Helene,
fantastic.
Not Helen.
Helene,
really,
not Helen.
quite the character.
Yeah.
Very informative.
Really unfortunate that we don't have time for a very important topic. I guess the very important topic for today is...
Watch the game on Saturday.
There you have it. Watch the game and...
Just
that's
it.
More like a very important
it.
Mandate.
Very
a little
important.
Vim.
we'll be back next week with a very important topic as normal. As we'll probably be doing something like five pro questions like we did last week. And I'm sure we're going to have a breakdown of ASU's unfortunate loss.
Oh my gosh, we're going at this again?
Oh, just kidding.
We're just the voice of reason.
Yeah.
Sorry,
hey,
Trey.
I hope I'm wrong.
The voice of hope. Tyler taught me to believe in myself.
Good.
In my teams.
Good.
And
good.
I believe.
Good. All right. Well, that's all we've got then. We got to get the heck out of here. This school is going to close down the doors around our ears. So,
just believe in yourself.
We've enjoyed your time. We hope you have as well. I'm Kyler Mead, Alex Gallant, Trey Lanthier. Thank you for listening. You have been in the Ninth Circle.
Just a small town girl living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere. Just a city boy born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going anywhere.
a singer in a smoke cave.